So at least one of you noticed that this is kind of a long slideshow in terms of slides. How many are in this?
41.
41 slides that we have to get through. It's not as bad as that sounds, though, because there's a lot of slides we can, compared to other slides, just blow through, because they're just basically examples. So it doesn't take as long, twice as long as a 20 slide show. It does take a while, though, and what I didn't realize, so I'm glad you mentioned that when you came in, because I looked at the syllabus and realized that I forgot to do what I've done before, which is split up the two halves of Botany of Desire. Next week is light, so that's when we're going to do the second one. So all we have to do is get through this. We don't have the movie after that. We're in the fourth unit now, the final unit, and so we just have four chapters left, all of which have to do with ecology, including, of course, this chapter, which is kind of a general ecology chapter in a sense, but it's also eventually about distribution of organisms. It wouldn't really make sense to dive into it unless we first define ecology, which of course is just a branch of biology, right? Biology, which is just one science, is by itself a huge science, which is why no one really practices in all of biology. You specialize within some little corner of biology. Even ecology by itself, which is just one corner of biology, is vast. But what is ecology just as a definition? What makes ecology ecology versus some other kind of biology? Any idea? Ecology is the study of interactions between an organism and its environment. Now, when I say the environment of an organism, I mean everything around it. So an organism interacts with abiotic surroundings, right? The rocks, the wind, the things that aren't alive. An organism interacts with other organisms as well, including other individuals of the same species, and also, of course, with other species as well. So there's all kinds of interactions, but that's all included within ecology. And what we see in the opening slide here is that you can study ecology as a biologist or as an ecologist at really any of the levels of biological organization that you probably learned on the first day of 181, right? When you talk about atoms making up molecules that make up organelles, that make up cells, and so on. Most of those levels, as you see here, you can study ecology at. Of course, it doesn't really make sense to talk about it until you get to the level of individual organisms, atoms, and molecular level doesn't really make sense. But there's organismal ecology. You can study it at the population level, at the community level, and so on. By the way, what is a population? We've defined this before in this course, but what is the definition? You're not allowed to forget this stuff after you take a test. It's a group of individuals of the same species living together somewhere. And actually, more than that, they're not only living together, they're successfully reproducing with each other. How is that different from a community? What is a community, in other words? Right. A community is all the populations that are living together. So they're different species, right? Each population is just one species. The community includes all the species living in whatever area that is. And then what about the next level up? What's different about an ecosystem? What's the difference between community and ecosystem? Note takers? Usually someone will reason that since a community is a group of populations, an ecosystem is a group of communities. But that's actually not what it is. Community is all the populations in an area, but that's it. Only the organisms, only the living things. If you include the community plus all the non-living things as well, like the rocks and the air and the water, then that's an ecosystem. So an ecosystem is the community plus the abiotic things in the same place. Okay, but anyway, you can study ecosystem all the way up to global ecology, including, which in other words is ecology of the entire biosphere. And one thing that we can say about ecology is that it is almost impossibly complex. Because if you think about what it means, the interactions, that's a complex thing to study, even if you focus in on just what one individual is doing with its surroundings, right? Let alone how different species interact with each other. It includes so many variables, and that's what I mean by the complexity, that you can't just ever really get in there and know the truth, kind of like physics does, you know, where you know the truth to the 10th decimal place or something like that. That's not what you can do in ecology, simply because it is so complex. It doesn't mean that it makes it hopeless and that we shouldn't bother studying it. It just makes it really difficult to study. Another thing that's difficult to study about it, especially at high levels, is how you make your measurements or how you do your experiments, right, at the global level. So it's complex and hard to really pin down in terms of absolute facts. Let's go to the second slide, though, and start talking about some biophysical aspects of ecology. What we have here is the Earth, if you haven't already noticed, the globe, being irradiated by sunlight. Sunlight is electromagnetic energy. And so the sunlight strikes the Earth. That is what is a continuous input of energy to the Earth. Without that sun continuously shining on Earth, none of us would be here, of course. But here we're really focused on the direct input of energy before that energy gets transformed by photosynthetic organisms and whatnot, which is an important part of ecology. Here we're just talking about pure energy delivered to the planet. And so each of these yellow swaths here, it's a two-dimensional view that we're looking at, but it really represents a column, a circular cylinder of light. And light, being electromagnetic energy, can be described as either wave-like or particle-like. It has both natures to it. If we talk about it as a wave, then you have wavelength and frequency that determines, for one thing, what color it looks like to us. But when you think about the particle nature of electromagnetic energy, what is that particle called? Not a particle with a mass, a photon. So a photon is one discrete packet of light energy. And so when you talk about a circular beam of light like these, that's quadrillions and quadrillions of photons making up that beam of light. All right? Those are coming from the sun. And it looks in this figure, or more than looks like it, it's drawn this way, that these beams are parallel, truly parallel. Of course, they're not really parallel. The sun is enormous. The Earth is tiny compared to the sun, which is not even a particularly big star, but it's our nearest one. The Earth is just a dot compared to the sun. But the sun is a hell of a long way away, right? And so the sun, of course, is not just shining its light to the earth. It's shining in all directions. Not only in two dimensions, which I'm drawing here, but in three dimensions. Anyway, the earth is capturing just a tiny fraction of that energy that the sun is continuously giving off. But because of the enormous distance, which I haven't really drawn to scale here, the beams of light that do strike the earth are almost parallel, right? If it were right up against the sun, they wouldn't be parallel. They would noticeably be non-parallel, but we wouldn't be here if we were close to the sun. Anyway, that's why it's drawn parallel. Not technically parallel, but it's close enough. Each beam, though, in this figure is equal in its magnitude. It's the same size column of light, has the same number of photons, same amount of energy. And they're striking the earth at different places on the globe, as you see. Well, this matters where they strike. Even though they all have the same amount of energy, they don't all have the same effect on the surface of the earth. And that's why you need to imagine this as what it is, not just light. It's a beam of many, many photons, individual photons, okay? So the energy intensity that is received by a surface that is being illuminated or irradiated can be thought of in terms of a density. Density is how many things get packed into a space or an area, right? So the intensity of energy being received by the surface, you can think of as the number of photons in that cross-section, that circular cross-section, divided by the area of that circle. Because that's photons per area. You see what I'm saying? If you're in this middle beam that's striking right at the equator, if you looked at the shape that would make, that would be a perfect circle. Right? Because you're hitting the earth at a normal angle, or normal is another word for perpendicular. You're hitting it perfectly perpendicular. That's going to form a circular region of illumination. The other beams, though, away from the equator, are not going to form circles. They're going to form ellipses, right? Or not actually perfect ellipses, but they're going to form some elongated region rather than just a circle. It's the same amount of energy, but now that number of photons is going to be divided by a bigger area that it's spread out over. And therefore, it has a smaller intensity. You see what I'm saying there? You're spreading the light out. And similarly, if you take a flashlight, you're going to make it brightest if you keep it normal to the table. If I'm shining on the table, if I come over here and at an oblique angle and shine it, it's the same amount of energy coming out of the flashlight, but it won't be nearly as bright looking because that's spread out over a bigger area. So this explains, this is the simple explanation for why the poles of the earth, or places on the earth where when you get toward the poles, either the north or the south pole, become colder. They're not receiving as much solar energy per unit area of their surface. Okay? If we go to slide 3, another look at the earth, but now we're focusing on wind and air movements. So we have an atmosphere here on Earth, unlike other things like the moon. And that's fundamentally different from the liquid and solid part of the surface, the ocean and the continents, because when they move, especially the continents, they stay in position, right? But the gaseous atmosphere, when the planet moves, slides past the planet, doesn't stay in one place, right? The air does not stay, the air that's over New York City does not stay over New York City all the time. It can move around. Well, these movements of air, of course, is called wind. Wind is an example of convection. Convection is one mode of heat transfer. Conduction is transfer of energy when things are in direct contact. Convection is the bulk movement of a fluid. So, for instance, blood gets convected in our bodies. That's an example of a bulk movement of a fluid. Wind is also convection, though. And these wind patterns have profound effects on organisms living in those wind, in those movements of air. Now, down at the surface where we live, wind can be from any direction in any given moment. Those are small-scale wind patterns. But there are also very large-scale wind patterns. And that's what we're looking at here, represented by these arrows. Now, if you look at the right edge of the globe here, where the inset is, that we see in close-up right here, notice that there's a swirling pattern. Okay, air is rising at the equator, then it's swirling back away from the equator and descending again to the surface, and that's happening over and over. Now, we're looking at that only at one edge. Of course, it's happening all around the surface. Okay? What causes this swirling, though, is what I just explained in the previous slide, how the sunlight works. So, sunlight striking the equator, that is the most intense light that we're getting, at least during the time of the year where the equator is directly facing the sun. But the equator and the two tropics right above and below it, those would get the most direct sunlight, so those are the warmest places. But anyway, when that direct intense sunlight hits the Earth, it of course heats it up more than any other part of the Earth, and that hot ground then, in direct contact with the air above it, conductively transfers heat to that air. And the air gets hot because it's in direct contact with the land. So this explains why the air is going to get warm, right? Now, why does it rise from the surface? We say often that hot air rises. That's actually not really telling the truth about what's happening. It is true that hot air rises, but not because it's not being forced up because it's hot. It's being forced up because something heavier than it is falling down and pushing it out of the way. Right? Just like if you have a mixture of little BB-sized pieces of wood and the equal-sized BB-sized pieces of lead, you shake that canister, the lead's going to fall to the bottom, right? And the wood's going to float, be forced up above it. So that's why hot air rises. But why is it lighter? I mean, it rises because it's lighter, and the heavier air descends to replace it. But why does it get lighter when it heats up? What happens to a gas when you heat it? It expands, which means the distance between those particles that make it up gets increased. Remember, that's the fundamental difference between a gas and a solid. It's the same exact particle types. They are just spaced out a hell of a lot more in a gas. And when you make that gas even warmer, there's even more space between the particles. So the density, which is the number of particles per volume, decreases because you're spacing them out more, right? And that makes it less heavy. Okay, now, that air that is about to rise because it's hot got hot because it was in direct contact with the land. The land, the soil, has water in it. And obviously, so does the ocean. Some of that air is in contact with the ocean. Whether it's in contact with the land or the ocean, though, it is picking up some water vapor. And more so when it's the more warm it gets, because when you warm up water, it evaporates more easily, right? Evaporation is the change in state from liquid to gas. So the air, which is a mixture of different gases, is also, one of those component gases in that mixture is water vapor that has evaporated from either ocean or land. And water vapor, by far, is the most variable of those components of air. So the percentage of nitrogen, which is most of air, it's roughly 3/4, stays about the same percentage. Same for oxygen. CO2 was pretty steady until the last 150 years, which is going to kill us. But it's still, compared to water vapor, very steady. But water vapor can go up and down drastically. You know, we feel that as humidity or very dry days. But anyway, it's one of the gases in air, and the amount of water vapor that the air is able to hold depends on the temperature of the air. The warmer the air, the more water vapor can be held in that air. What I mean by being held is that air has a limit to how much water vapor it can handle. It can be saturated with water vapor, which means you can't add anymore. And when it becomes saturated, the temperature at which that occurs is for that given amount of water is called the dew point. Right? If you get the temperature below the dew point, you've reduced the ability of the air to handle that much water anymore, and therefore it has to come out as water, as liquid water, which forms dew when it gets cold in the morning. But just the opposite is true as well. If you heat up air, it can hold more and more water vapor. So this hot air is able to pick up a lot of water vapor from the surface. So it's not just hot air, it's hot, moist air that's rising from the equator. Okay? And blue here represents water level in the arrow. Notice the arrow changes colors. Okay, now, when it rises, when you get air farther away from the surface of the Earth, what happens to it? It gets colder. So it's rising because it was warm, being forced away because of the heavier cold air coming down. But as it rises, just like as you climb a mountain, it becomes noticeably cooler, right? And so when you cool that air that used to be able to handle that much water vapor because it was warm, it can no longer hold that much water vapor. So the water vapor that was in that formerly warm air condenses out as liquid, which we see as clouds, and it falls as liquid precipitation. All right? So that formerly warm, wet, or humid air that came away from the equator is now cold and dry air. The water gets dumped near the equator on either side, either north or south of it, which is why the tropics, which is what we call those regions, are so wet. It rains a hell of a lot because that cold air loses the water it picked up. So now the arrow is yellowish, meaning it's lost its water. And it's cold now, cold, dry air, and therefore much more compact, because the spacing between the molecules is reduced as it cools, and that makes it now heavy again. So it's the air that falls back down and pushes the now hot air up again, continuing this swirl. But since it's dry air that's coming down in these latitudes right here, that means that dry air is going to scrape against the land and pick up any water that's there from that soil, making those soil drier and drier. And so that's why in these latitudes you find the great deserts of the world. A desert is a place with very little water. We're living in one right now, but there's plenty of deserts. Most of the deserts, though, are in these regions of the earth, because that's where this dry air is coming back down and wicking the moisture away from those ecosystems. So that explains the swirl. It doesn't explain the diagonality of these arrows, though. So it's not just swirling in place like this. Well, it would if the earth was just sitting in place, but it's not, right? The whole time this swirling is happening, the earth is moving. It's rotating on its axis. Rotation is the spin of the earth. And since the air is a fluid, it sloshes with respect to the earth, doesn't stay in one place, and therefore that swirling turns into this diagonal pattern, and those are major wind patterns, although driven by sunlight, basically, hitting the earth and delivering different intensities of irradiation. I just mentioned rotation. We're on slide 4 now. That is the spinning of a body around its own axis, like a top. The Earth is doing that, which explains, you know, that's ecologically important as well, of course, because that determines the dial or daily cycle, right? Day and night, which has affected evolution of all organisms. But here we're looking at revolution. Revolution is the movement of a body around another body. So we are orbiting or revolving around the sun. And you already know, of course, that temperature changes not only daily, because sometimes we're getting sunlight during the day and sometimes we're not, and therefore it gets cooler at night, but also there are seasonal changes in temperature, right? Especially different places. We have seasonality here too, but there's more drastic seasonality in other places. It can get extremely cold and extremely hot in different parts of the year. But this is not because of different of a change in distance from the Earth to the Sun. Now we do change because anything that orbits or revolves around something else does not do so in a circle. An orbit is really an ellipse, not a circle. And ellipses can have different degrees of eccentricity, which is how round they are. The more eccentric they are, the more their two foci, which is simply the plural of focus, are separated. A circle is really just a special case of an ellipse where the two foci are really the same point. We call that the center. But for any other ellipse, the two foci are separated a certain distance, and that determines the eccentricity of the ellipse. Anyway, for any heavenly body orbiting around another one, the thing that is being orbited around, like the sun in this case, is at one of these two foci. So the other one is not inhabited by a body. It's just mathematically the focus is there, but only one of them has the thing that's being revolved around. And that means that the distance between the Earth, which is somewhere on this path, to the sun actually does change. But it doesn't change by very much. Percentage-wise, it's tiny. And that's because even though it is an ellipse, the orbit of the Earth around the sun is almost a circle because the two foci are very close together. All right? So the difference between this distance and this distance and different time of the year is negligible. So that's not why it gets cold in the winter. And as a matter of fact, it should make sense that would be impossible for that to be accountable for it, because, as you know, when it's cold in the northern hemisphere, it's warm. And when it's winter here, it's summer in the southern hemisphere, and vice versa, right? So if it were due to different distances from the sun, that would be impossible, since everywhere on Earth is the same distance from the sun. That's not the reason. Instead, it has to do with the tilt of the axis of the Earth. So we have a plane of revolution. That's the mathematical plane that the Earth stays in that you would draw the ellipse in, right? That's just like the tabletop stays in that plane. The earth is not, the earth's axis is not perpendicular to that plane of revolution. If it were, then there wouldn't be seasonality, because the amount of sunlight would stay the same all the way around that orbit for each place on earth. Instead, it's tilted. It's slightly oblique compared to the plane of revolution. And therefore, at any given part of the orbit, in other words, any given day of the year, part of the earth is going to be facing the sun more than the other part. And when it's in the tilt, I mean, when it's in the part of the orbit where the northern hemisphere is being tilted toward the sunlight, it makes it more like the equator that time of year. It's getting the most direct sunlight. And the southern hemisphere is getting much more oblique sunlight, so it's colder there. 6 months later, though, since the tilt stays the same, the northern hemisphere is pointed away from the sunlight, and now it's cold there, and the southern hemisphere is getting the direct sunlight. So that explains the seasonality. And the four extremes are that we have two solstices, a winter and a summer solstice. Each of those is the beginning of the season officially. The winter solstice, which is usually December 21st, that's the first day of winter. Well, it's defined. The solstice is the special day in which the amount of day length is shortest. The night length is longest. And then the summer solstice, 6 months later, first day of summer, it has the longest day length and the shortest. The equinoxes, on the other hand, which are 3 months away from each solstice, one in spring and one in fall, are called equinoxes because there's equal day and night lengths. But that happens because the tilt is right to the side compared to the sun, so northern and southern hemispheres get the same illumination, same intensity. Now another, these have all been abiotic things, right? We haven't even talked about any organisms, but they're important to organisms that live on the globe. Here's another one that's abiotic, non-living. Major ocean currents. Now we talk about the so-called oceans. We give them different names, Pacific, Atlantic, whatnot. There really is one big ocean. There's no ocean that's cut off as a body of water from all the others, right? So we call them that simply because they're kind of almost surrounded by land masses, but they're not truly cut off. There's really just one big ocean. And the swirling can happen all the way around all the named oceans. Well, that swirling we call ocean currents. And there are some major ocean currents that really affect living conditions, because currents carry water, of course. That's what a current is, a water current. But they also carry heat. Anything that is material, including water, has heat. Heat, by the way, is not the same thing as temperature. They're kind of related, but they're fundamentally different. Heat is the energy of the motion of particles of some sample. It's an example of what we call an extensive property. It's called that because the extent, meaning how much you have, matters. How much sample you have, that is. Temperature, on the other hand, is an example of an intensive property. The extent of sample does not matter. A familiar example I use is to think about a swimming pool, certain amount of water in there, right? Temperature is really a measure of the average speed of the particles of that sample. And this is why how much you have doesn't matter, because an average doesn't care about how much you have, right? You divide that number off, or you add it all up, and then you divide by the number you have. So the average doesn't get bigger as you add more and more samples, right? So obviously, a pool will have a certain temperature. You can stick a thermometer in there and get a good temperature. If you then take a glass of water out of that pool, as long as you measure the temperature immediately, it's going to be the same as it is for the pool. But the heat in the glass and the heat contained in the pool are drastically different because there's a hell of a lot more particles of water in the pool. So there's a hell of a lot more heat in that pool. Well, the ocean is a tremendously big pool. And so when you have these major ocean currents moving big batches of water around, you're moving, you're redistributing massive amounts of heat to different parts of the globe. And what you see here is that some of these currents carry warmer water, others carry cooler water. So the Gulf Stream that you've probably heard of, notice it is a current that travels along the eastern United States, the shoreline of the east coast. And it's a warm current compared to the other currents, which has the effect of warming this east coast more than you'd expect it to be. It picks up heat from the eastern part and redistributes it to Western Europe. And Western Europe is, as a result, warmer than you would think based on its latitude. So the latitude is how far away you are from the equator, right? And when you go to high latitude, that means away from the equator in either direction. The equator is zero. The North Pole is 90 degrees. The South Pole is 90 degrees. So either way, going up in latitude means going toward a pole and therefore getting colder based on light intensity, right? Well, if you look at a map that has both the United States and Europe on it, or North America and Europe, Europe is pretty high up there, meaning you'd expect it to be cold as hell there. Well, certain parts are cold as hell, obviously, but a lot of Europe is comparable to places in the United States, even though the United States is at a lower latitude. And that's because a lot of heat gets picked up by this Gulf Stream and delivered to Europe, making it a warmer place than it would be based on just its latitude alone. Meanwhile, this California current cools off the West Coast, which is why San Francisco, for instance, is famous for being cold as hell sometimes when you wouldn't think it would be based on where it is. That has drastic effects on especially non-humans because they have to live outdoors. Okay, now let's go to 6. Here we have a mountain range near a coast. So it doesn't matter where this is, but a good example of this would be the Sierra Nevada Mountains near the Pacific coast of California. You have airflow coming in from the ocean. So this air that was over the ocean obviously has become humidified, right? Because it's in direct contact with a huge mass of water. So it's moist air coming in. When that air coming inland hits the mountain, the mountain is a much stronger thing than the air. So the mountain, even though over a long, long time, the mountain will erode because of that air, the mountain isn't going anywhere in these few minutes or in hours. So the airflow is forced upward just because it can't get through the mountain and it has to go over it. And when it goes over the mountain, especially a mountain that's fairly tall, that means it's going to significantly cool, right? Because the peak of the mountain is higher off, it's higher elevation, just like we were talking about before with the ascending air at the equator. So this humid air that's able to handle that much water vapor cools down and therefore can no longer hold the amount of water. And it rains like hell on this side of the mountain, where the air is blowing toward. When it gets to the top, it descends back down the other side of the mountain, but by then it has lost most of the water. So that means what we have on the other side of the mountain is called a rain shadow. That leeward side, away from the wind, is going to face dry conditions. And so on a mountain, you can have one side of it, which is basically geographically identical to the other side, and you would think, therefore, have the same conditions, have drastically different things living on them, on one side versus the other, because there's drastically different amounts of moisture that they receive. Amount of water received is a fundamentally important ecological variable, because water obviously is fundamental to life. Okay, now let's go to 7. Here we're not really concerned with the ocean, just the land masses where you see the different colors, and these different regions that are shaded different colors represent different biomes or ecosystems. Those are roughly the same things. These are terrestrial biomes that we're looking at, because terrestrial means on land versus marine or aquatic, which is in water. What is the difference, by the way, between aquatic and marine? They both mean in water or having to do with water, but what's the difference? Yeah, marine is salt water, and aquatic is fresh water, lakes and rivers versus ocean. But this is terrestrial biomes that we're looking at. Tropical rainforest, savanna, and so on is listed here. 10 major ones. And there's more than one of each, but every time you see this color on the map, that's a tropical rainforest and so on. These are important because living conditions are pretty drastically different in the different kinds of biomes. And so that's, of course, a fundamental concern of ecologists. What is living there is a fundamental question of ecology. What is able to live there? What's not able to live there? These terrestrial biomes, by the way, even though all the things that are living there are of interest to ecologists, they are usually defined, or named for, often named for, and usually defined by the predominant type of vegetation that can live there. Now, why does that make sense? Why name it after plants versus animals, for instance? Not that those are the only two kinds of things in the world, but those are two major kinds of things. Why would we give special attention to the plants of the world that live in a region? Because on land, plants are the major producers. And that is a fundamentally important ecological thing as well. If you think of organisms in general, we talked about this back when we talked about the trophic breakdown, that one table I gave you. There's two fundamentally different kinds of organisms in the world, ecologically speaking, right? There are producers and there are consumers. Those are the words we would use in ecology. If you wanted to talk about it in terms of the ability or the inability to fix carbon, then we would, what's another name for a producer? The words we learned before. An autotroph, right. The autotrophs are the producers of the world. The heterotrophs are the consumers. And the reason we pay attention or define these biomes based on the predominant vegetation is that the producers are absolutely vital. The consumers have to have the producers. They can't exist without them. So whatever kind of plants can live there determines what kind of animals and other things can live there as well. Well, here's where we can... not quite yet. I have to get through this slide first. But here's where we can... We're getting to the point where we can go through them a little quicker because they're example slides. In slide 8, though, first we'll look at a graph that is an example of something we call a climagraph. Same root as in climate. By the way, climate and weather are not the same thing. Sometimes anti-scientific people who want to deny the overwhelming evidence of global warming will intentionally confuse the two. You know, you get a cold snap and they'll say, where's your global warming? That's a stupid thing to do when they, I mean, I say stupid when they know better. If you're genuinely stupid and don't know the difference, that's a different story. But there's a lot of people who do it knowing that they're lying. Anyway, climate is very broad scale changes or patterns. So seasonality is more about climate than day-to-day changes, which is weather. Whether or not it's going to rain that day is fundamentally different from how much annual rainfall do you get, which is more of a climate thing. Here we have a climagraph, though, which is, as you see, a graph of temperature versus precipitation, moisture, in other words. And those same colors are used in this graph to correspond to the different biomes that you saw geographically distributed on the map, because that's where they actually are. Well, here we're representing its regions on this XY plane. As, in other words, each biome represents a set of points that, and each point is part temperature and part moisture, right? So if you have high X value and a high Y value, that means it's warm and, well, warm is top, and wet. So it makes sense that the tropical rainforest region is right there. That's a warm, wet place. Deserts are called deserts. By definition, they have very little water. So it makes sense that they are found on the left edge, where the value for precipitation is very low. By the way, sometimes people think of deserts as meaning hot places, and most deserts are hot. But the word desert really only means dry. There are cold deserts as well. Although, sometimes we use different words for them, like tundra. Tundra is a cold desert, but it's still on this left edge. Left lower because it's not only dry, it's cold as well. Hot deserts, like the one we live in, are upper left because it's cold, I mean it's hot and dry. Anyway, that's a climagraph. Now we can look through several slides at just examples of these places. A tropical rainforest is well named. Rainforests are well named because it rains every day. And that's because of what I was telling you before about picking up the water and then dumping it back on Earth when the water rises so high that it gets cool. These are ecologically really important. There's no such thing as a biome that's not ecologically important, but rainforests are particularly important in terms of biodiversity, which is a big ecological concern, because they feature the greatest density of different organisms living in one place. That's where, I mean, you can go literally just take a handful of soil from a tropical forest, and there will be many species in your hand that have never been discovered still, microscopic ones. Notice the vegetation, lush vegetation, because there's so much sunlight and so much water that they're not really limited in their growth by those two things. In 10, we see a savanna, which is a grassland. It's a type of grassland. Grass is not the only thing growing here, though. In a savanna, you do have some trees. In other grasslands, you don't have any trees at all. You only have grasses. But that's because of the reason grasses grow so well is that they tolerate long periods of drought as long as there's occasional water dumped there, which you get in savannas. 11 is right at home here. This is Sonoran Desert. We're looking at Oregon Pipe National Monument, which is nearby. So this is not only a desert, but a hot desert. You know what it looks like, of course, because you live in it, but deserts are places where you don't have nearly as much production. There's plenty of light, obviously, so plants have a lot of energy coming in that they can work with, but they're limited in deserts by the amount of water they have. So there's sparse vegetation, and therefore, since there's not as many producers, it can't support as many consumers. Chaparral in California in slide 12. where you have a lot of fires. Chaparrals are dominated by shrubbery, which is why they burn so well when they dry out. So there are no huge trees, mostly bushes, as you see here. Grassland in Mongolia, slide 13. This is well named. You don't see anything but grass. Of course, there are animals living in there as well, and other plants as well, but no big trees. Grass is basically the only thing that can withstand those long droughts that they go through. Coniferous forest in Norway, 14. What is a coniferous forest versus some other kind of forest? Right. It's full of conifers, in other words. Conifers are the major types of gymnosperms that exist still today, right? We talked about gymnosperms and angiosperms. Well, most gymnosperms are conifers, and they do well at places that are a little colder, right? Which is why you can find them here, but you have to go up in elevation where it's cold enough for them to live. But you can also go up in latitude where it's cold even low down, and you'll see a lot of conifers. 15 is a temperate broadleaf forest that is what most of the United States looked like naturally. It doesn't anymore because humans have turned it into other things, mainly places to grow crops. Just in natural state, it would mostly have been this. And there are places that are left, but it's becoming fewer and fewer. Broadleaf forests, though, feature trees with broad or wide leaves that are deciduous, unlike the conifers. Conifers are evergreens. They don't undergo abscission like normal broadleaf trees do. Why does abscission occur? What is abscission, I should say? We talked about this last week. Right, which causes the leaves to fall, right? But why does that occur seasonally? Well, when it gets cold, first of all, when it gets cold in the winter, it also gets much less light. So you can't do as good a job of photosynthesis even if everything else were the same. But also when it gets cold, you're really just in danger of losing water through these leaves that aren't really doing you all that much good. So basically these trees evolutionarily have decided to shut down production, become sparse in terms of their body, kind of like us bundling up. Now, when you're cold, you don't keep big flat pieces of your body out because you'll get even colder, right? So they drop those things and then grow them again when it's warmer and sunnier. 16, here's an example of a tundra. So this is also a very dry place, but it's a cold desert. You see these very high latitudes toward the poles. This one's in Norway, as you see. And just like things don't grow very lushly in our hot desert, things don't in a tundra as well, because water is the limiting factor, basically. So you have vegetation that is very sparse, but also very low to the ground, right? We have huge cacti, for instance, that are nowhere near the surface of the earth, but you don't see that in a tundra. Well, these are not only limited by water, they're obviously also cold. And the warmest place, even though it's only comparatively warmer, is at the surface. The farther from the surface you get, you're going to get even colder because the wind is going to be more strong the farther you get from the surface, and the temperatures will drop. But also, with a small, compact body, a plant is not going to lose as much heat. Those were all terrestrial biomes. 17 is an example of an aquatic biome. Here we have a wetland in the UK. Now, wetlands, all these biomes really are in danger more and more because of human activity. But wetlands have been really damaged, which is dangerous because wetlands are really important stopovers for a lot of animals that migrate, whether it's birds stopping there or other things that are walking around in their migration. But wetlands are named for the fact that they are wet, obviously. They're found in places that aren't really at the coast. I mean, it's not all the way into the ocean, but it's close there, close by. And so they're really important biodiversity spots, but they're becoming more and more ruined by human activity. 18, we have a lake. Now, what is the difference between a lake and a sea? The type of water, really. Lake and pond, same thing. Basically, it's just a difference in size, right? A lake is fresh water, as a pond is. A sea actually can be fresh water as well, but it's kind of a word that we use for a pretty damn big piece of water. But then there are other seas that are named seas because they're really just extensions of the ocean. So they are marine versus aquatic. Well, that makes a big difference because obviously those are two totally different lifestyles that have to be taken to live in those places. You can't take a freshwater fish out of a lake and put it into the ocean and expect it to live. Why is that, by the way? What's the main reason for that? What's the starkest difference between these two types of environments in terms of physiology? What is it? Yeah, but what does that cause? What difference does that cause? Oh, is that what you said originally? I thought you said salinity. Oh, okay, yeah, but yes, you're right. Different salinity causes different tonicity, right? So a freshwater existence, you're living in a fluid that is hypotonic, which means you face continuous uptake of water into your body. You have too much water, in other words. You want to keep it out of your cells. If you live in the ocean, you live in a hypertonic environment. So you face continuous desiccation. Even though you live in water, you're going to lose your water to the ocean. So you can't just expect one to live in the other. Anyway, if we go to 19, we see a headwater stream. Headwater, by the way, simply refers to the beginning of a river. Where do rivers begin, by the way? When you see a river, you see the water flow, and you know it's coming from somewhere, but where does the river start? No, it ends at the ocean, actually. It dumps into the ocean, or dumps into a lake, in some cases. Starts in mountains, starts in the highest places, because the water is moving simply because it's falling downhill, right? So where does it come? Where does the water in the mountain come from? Rain. Rain, you know, you'll have trickles of water first, not very big, but then they'll come together and form a slightly bigger trickle of water, which eventually will be called a stream. Streams get together, you have a river, and rivers can undergo confluence to become an even bigger river, and then eventually you dump it into a huge body of water. Along the way, though, there can be drastically different ecosystems. Living right here, for instance, where you have multiple levels, there might be an entirely different population of organisms living here that never get anywhere of the other places that are different places to live because there are different sets of organisms living there. Slide 20 is an intertidal zone. Well, intertidal simply means between tides, right? By the way, the tides are caused by high tide and low tide, that is caused by the fact that there's movement of ocean water. But what is causing the tides? Why is there a high tide a certain time of the day? And it's not the same time of day, by the way, every day. But there's a high tide at a certain time. You can look it up in the paper, and then there's going to be a low tide at a certain time. What is that? What causes that? Right. The moon is a pretty big piece of rock. pretty close to the Earth. It's 1/6 as big as the Earth, so it's a huge... There's a lot of gravity that's exerting on the Earth, right? The Earth's exerting gravity on the Moon is exerting gravity on the Earth. But the Moon doesn't stay in one position, of course. The Moon is a satellite of the Earth, so it's revolving around the Moon just like the Earth is revolving around the Sun. Wherever it is at any given moment, though, that side of the Earth, the water that's on that side of the Earth, is going to be drawn toward the Moon a little bit. Doesn't seem like much, and it isn't really all that much when if you were looking at it, but just 1 inch difference in sea level, think of how much water that is. So it bulges out toward the Moon on this side of the Earth, and therefore there's more water there. That's going to be high tide there. On the other side of the Earth, where the Moon, opposite where the Moon is, that's where the water comes from, where it gets attracted by gravity. So that causes low tide there. And it just keeps going between high and low. Well, intertidal zones are interesting places ecologically because the things that live there have to be special kinds of organisms, right? If you live in the intertidal zone, that means part of the day you are living a terrestrial lifestyle when the tide is out. And part of the day, you're underwater. A lot of things can't survive that, right? They have to be either fully in the ocean or fully on land. It's not only the water, by the way. You also go from being cold when there's a large depth of water to very hot when the sun is beating down on a very shallow piece of water. It gets a lot hotter. Coral reef, slide 21. Coral reefs are another thing that's truly in danger, mostly because of CO2 in the atmosphere, global warming. Not so much because of the temperature, but because of other things I'll talk about later. But this is a shame because coral reefs are kind of like the rainforests of the ocean in terms of biodiversity. There's a hell of a lot of ocean. And when you add all the life that's in there together, it's a lot of the Earth's life is in the ocean. And that's, of course, where it started. But in terms of density, it's not all that great compared to like a rainforest because it's so spread out. There's so much area, so much space in the ocean. Coral reefs, on the other hand, is a big concentration of different species, kind of like a rainforest. So they have tremendous biodiversity, and when they suffer, that means a lot of things go extinct because they rely on the coral reefs. 22, open ocean. Well, speaking of spreading things out, when you get far away from land, you start appreciating just how much water is in that ocean. And like I said, there's a lot of things out there, but there's a lot of distance between them. So it's kind of sparsely populated. And also, it's really deep. Well, most of that life is close to the surface, which makes sense because that's the only place where the producers of the ocean can live, right? Well, I shouldn't say only. Where most of the producers, it's the only place where the photosynthetic producers can live because they can't be so deep in the ocean that where there's no light penetrating, right? And therefore, that's where most of the consumers are as well because they either eat the producers or they eat things that eat the producers. And it's concentrated near the surface. There are things living, though, at tremendous depths as well, though, because there's, even in total darkness, when there aren't any more producers, there's a continuous precipitation or falling of dead stuff, which is organic material that other things that live at depth can eat continuously. But when you get to depth, then it really becomes sparse, because you're away from land and at great depth. Well, speaking of depth, 23 is a hydrothermal vent. Deep sea. So this has obviously been photographed with a flash. These things that you see here are tube worms. There's more than just that there, but they are the major animals that we're looking at here. I don't know what they thought about the flash, but they live in total darkness all the time, because this is at the bottom of the ocean. So obviously there can't be any photosynthetic organisms down there. But any community, no matter where it is, which remember, community is all the populations, any community has to have producers, because the consumers can't exist without the producers. Well, these tube worms are animals, so they're not autotrophs. The producers that are here aren't plants or any other photosynthesizers, because there's no light. What they are unicellular organisms that are chemoautotrophs. Remember, there are photoautotrophs and chemoautotrophs. So they're not undergoing photosynthesis, they're undergoing chemosynthesis using the energy released at the hydrothermal vent as their source. 24. Well, let's look at this cartoon and go through these definitions of different zones, zonation in bodies of water. There is the so-called photic zone, which is named for the fact that it's right at the surface and therefore receives light to a certain depth, right? Photic means having to do with light. Well, obviously the very surface is receiving light. When you go to any depth, though, there's going to be some light that penetrates, but it doesn't penetrate very far. Eventually you'll get to a depth where no useful light is penetrating, and therefore photosynthetic organisms can't live there anymore. So that's why the photic zone is so important ecologically. That's where photosynthetic production is occurring. Notice that's a vertical definition, photic zone. So it's a certain depth. No matter where you are with respect to closeness to land, the photic zone is the same depth, but right at the surface. Below that, deeper than the photic zone, is the aphotic zone, which simply means not photic, dark in other words. And that's where I said other things are living, but they're having to rely on the stuff that is falling down on them from the photic zone. Well, the combination of those two is the entire depth. We call that the pelagic zone. Now, the floor of a body of water is called the benthos. And therefore, wherever you are, once again, irrespective of where the coastline is, if you're actually on the floor, however deep it is, then you're living a benthic lifestyle. That's the benthic zone, right? Just at the floor. And then, finally, you have the littoral zone and the limnetic zone. In those two terms, it does matter how far away from land you are. So as you see here, it's a horizontal definition. The littoral zone is the part of the surface that's right up against the land, which has different things living in it. It also is the shallow part, by the way, simply because that's where it's hitting land. And then there's the limnetic zone, which is farther out from the shore. This is a flow chart that kind of is a schematic view of fundamental type of question that ecologists concern themselves with. Why is species X absent from an area? I mentioned this before, right? That's one important thing that ecologists care about, is why is it that this biome can support these kind of organisms but not these other kinds of organisms? Which is just another way of saying, why is species X, whatever that is, not here, not at this place? Well, it could be that its dispersal is limiting its distribution. Dispersal refers to the spreading out of a population. And so, in other words, it's a yes or no question of, is this species actually able to spread out and occupy from somewhere else, spread out into this current area? That's a yes or no question, right? So that's why this is a binary flow chart. Well, you don't just make a guess, you have to make measurements of that, but it could be yes or no. If it is yes, or if the answer to dispersal does limit it, that means something is keeping it from spreading there. whether it's a body of water that it can't get across or some barrier, right? That's one fundamental thing. If not, if it's not limited by its dispersal, then there must be some other reason, and maybe it's biotic factors. Living things, in other words, that limit it. Well, that's its own yes or no question. So that's a different study that would have to be undertaken. If it is biotic factors, these could be things like predators that are living in the area that would kill them, and they just wouldn't be successful. That's what predation is. Parasitism, you know, there might be things that would serve as parasites that, to keep them unhealthy and so on. But if not, if it's not biotic factors, then it must be abiotic factors. Because it's one or the other, right? Either biotic or abiotic. And if it's abiotic factors, then it could be chemical factors or physical factors, as we see here. Chemicals like water, oxygen, chemical factors like pH. On the other hand, the physical factors are the things we were talking about at the beginning of the term, the beginning of the chapter, when I said we were talking about biophysical aspects. Physical factors are temperature and light and water content and so on, or amount of water, moisture in other words. This little bird cartoon is used in this chapter to illustrate something that is really just plain old common sense. So this is probably not going to seem difficult at all. What we have here, though, is a population represented by the birds here. And any given population has a population size, obviously, right? How many individuals there are. Well, what this is trying to show you, which is the not surprising thing, is that the size of a population depends on immigration, it depends on emigration, it depends on births, and it depends on deaths. Right? That's why I say it makes perfect sense. The more births you have, the more individuals are added. The more deaths you have, the more individuals are removed. The more immigration you have, the more the population grows because you're adding individuals from some other population. And the more emigration you have, the more things leave, in other words, the more it goes down. So it's not hard to understand that these four things affect population, but they all, you have to account for all of them to actually get a gauge on how the population stability is. Population size is important, by the way, for reasons we'll get into later, when it comes to the health of a particular species, which make up that population, and in turn, the health of the overall community, because when certain members of the community start going extinct, there's kind of a domino effect. The other things start going extinct as well. That's why we care about the health of populations. Now, I mentioned distribution before when we had that flow chart. In slide 27, we can see that there are three major distribution patterns that populations represent, or the populations can exhibit. The sea star example, those used to be called starfish, now they're called sea stars. That's representing a clumped distribution. And the photograph is a good example, but the little dot schematics actually show you the definition better, I think, than the photographs. Clumped, it means that small groups of individuals are clumped together closely. And there are several clumps in the overall population with space between them, but there's clumping of individuals. And that's not by accident. Those individuals are intentionally, in a sense, close to each other. Okay? So it's not just that it's random. Well, then you have the penguins that represent a uniform distribution. Notice that there's equal spreading, more or less equal spreading between each individual. In other words, each one is trying to maximize its personal space. They don't want to clump, in other words. That's also not accidental. That's intentional. The one that's accidental is the random distribution, represented by the dandelions. Now, obviously, there are going to be clumps where you have more than one dandelion in place compared to another place that doesn't have any. But that's not because the dandelions are clumping together intentionally. It's simply because the wind carried the seeds to random places, and they grew where they landed. So any given population is closest to one of these three. These are the three possibilities mathematically, basically. Okay, more about populations in 28. Here we have a graph that is known as a survivorship curve. And really, this is three survivorship curves all in the same graph, which is why we see the three different colors here. For any given species, you would draw just one survivorship curve representing the entire species. But it's called a survivorship curve because it graphs the number of survivors on the y-axis versus time. Now notice here, time is represented in this composite one as percentage of maximum lifetime. If you were doing just one species, you could do it years or days or whatever. But if you put it as percentage of maximum lifetime, that makes every species go from 0 to 100, even if they have different lifetimes, right? That way you can graph them all on the same one. That's why it's done that way. Anyway, there are three, as you can see, three major categories of survivorship curve types or shapes, the so-called type 1, type 2, and type 3 in Roman numerals. And we humans are good representatives of the type 1 survivorship curve, because there is high survivability early on in life when the X is when you're at the left. Very high, close to 100%, right? And then you eventually get to an age when it becomes much more likely each year that you're going to die, and the members of the population that are that age start dropping like flies, right? Precipitously. Until you get to 100%, which is the end of the life. That is kind of the opposite of the type 3, which is represented here by the oyster. They have very low survivability, very high die-off early in life, meaning that most individuals don't make it through that first year or first season or whatever it is, depending on the species. They're very precarious, easy for predators to find, or for whatever reason, they can't live very well. So only the very lucky few do. Once you make it through the first rough seasons or years, though, then it starts to even out. So they tend to live a long time after that, once they make it. Well, the only other possibility is kind of the combination between the two, the straight line. It's now, obviously, there's no such thing as a perfectly straight line when you do this with real data. But ideally, there's a straight line that is halfway between these two curves. That's the type 2 survivorship curve. And what that straight line means is that age doesn't really matter. There's a pretty continuous die-off for the old and the young alike. And you just lose a certain amount, which doesn't change as a rate over that whole lifetime. By the way, the reason that there can be such drastic differences is it depends on how the species lives. Humans invest a hell of a lot of energy in their offspring, in each individual. It's expensive to make a huge offspring like a baby, smaller than the adult, but it's bigger than a tiny little spore, right? It takes energy to build that thing. And therefore, if it's allowed to die, it would be a big loss. So we put a lot of energy into building very small number of offspring that have a pretty high chance of surviving. And in fact, we keep spending energy long after they're born, right, in the case of humans. Another 18 years of supporting them before they're finally on their own. That's not what oysters do. They make a lot of cheap, small offspring. which is why it's not a problem if 90% of them die in the first year, because you've made so many that some will live. All right? That's basically the difference between the 1 and 3, which are the extremes. That brings us to 29. More graph to look at and a little bit of math to talk about. Here we have population growth curves. So this is a totally different kind of graph, but we're still talking about populations. And what's graphed on the y, as you see, is population size at any given moment versus time once again, but here it's number of generations, which is just a measure of time, right? So as you go to the right on the x-axis, you're going to more and more generations, therefore into the future. And you notice these curves are both, even though the red and the blue are not identical, they're both not only continuously increasing, so the population size is getting bigger and bigger, but the rate at which the population is growing is itself getting bigger. So it's not just that the population is getting bigger, that's growth of the population. The rate of growth of the population, so how fast it's growing, is also growing. Okay? And we know that as an exponential curve. This is an exponential growth rate. Now, we have a little bit of calculus here. dN dt is an example of what in calculus? Anyone have calculus? What is dN dt an example of? Right, it's a derivative. And what is a derivative? Anyone explain that? There were two important problems hundreds of years ago that humans wanted to solve, which is why calculus was invented. One was to try to figure out what the slope of a line is if that line is tangent to a curve. Tangent means it's just touching it at one point. Right? So I'd like to know what the slope of that line is, which is different from the slope of the tangent line at a different point on the curve. Right? It's useful to know that for various reasons. But that was something that you couldn't calculate with algebra. That's why calculus was invented. The other reason was wanting to know what the area under a curve is, what this area is. Can't do that with algebra either. You need calculus. That's what integrals are for. Derivatives, though, are really just a calculation of what the slope of a tangent line is to a curve. Well, think about on this graph what the slope is. In any slope of any line, what is that defined as? How is slope defined? Even in algebra. Do you know what I mean by the slope of a line, mathematically? How do you calculate slope? If you have a straight line and it's on a graph, how do you calculate the slope? It's rise over run, right? You've heard this phrase. In other words, it's the vertical change, how far you have to get up or down, divided by the horizontal change, the run. So from this point to this point, it would be rise, however many y values there are, divided by x values. Change in y divided by change in x. Okay, that's what the slope is. But think about what the slope is in terms of units. Rise has units of y, right? Run, the horizontal part, has units of x. That means for any given graph, a line, the slope of a line, has units of y per x. Does that make sense? Rise over run. Well, in this particular graph, a line would have a slope that has units of population size per year, or per generation. Per time, in other words, right? So what does it mean to say a change in population, which is that delta y, per year, which is delta x? That's another way of saying how fast the population is growing. Just like if you plotted distance in y over time, then the slope would represent the speed, change in distance per time, miles per hour, kilometers per hour, whatever. See what I'm saying here? So, the slope is the population growth rate, change in population size over time. And that's why we use calculus to get to it, because these are curves. dN dt is the growth rate of the population. And notice that for the exponential population growth, which both of these are examples of, the general formula is growth rate, which is dN dt, equals some constant. Here it's 0.5, here it's 1, but it's some constant, it doesn't change, times n. Well, what is n? Population itself. This is why it's continuously growing, because the growth rate, which is dN dt, depends on the population size at the moment. When you have a bigger population, that means it's going to grow even faster, because you're multiplying that bigger n by that constant. Does that make sense? Well, that's the essence of exponential growth. The growth rate itself is growing continuously, and that's why the curve gets steeper and steeper as you go to the right. There is no such thing as an exponentially growing real population indefinitely. What I mean is that no population can grow exponentially for very long or for an indefinite amount of time. But when a population is early on, it can seem like it's exponential for a while. Now, why can it be indefinitely exponential? Because something eventually is going to limit its growth. It's going to run out of something, or something else is going to limit it, right? For instance, bacteria are a good example of exponential growth early on, because you start, you know, you spread bacteria onto a plate like you've done. You don't see them because they're invisible, but one individual bacterium landed somewhere on that plate. 20 minutes later, it became two because it split into two. 20 minutes after that, it became four. It's doubling every 20 minutes. So after just 40 generations, which is 40 times 20 minutes, you have 2 to the 40th bacteria where you started with just one. 2 to the 40th is over 1 trillion. And if this is happening with all bacteria, within a month there would be bacteria all over the surface of the earth up to our ankles or higher. And that doesn't happen because there's not unlimited food for these things, right? Something comes along and limits them. In that case, it's food supply. We'll talk about density-dependent checks on population in a little bit. But the point here is that real populations can exhibit exponential growth only up to a point, and then something has to change it. So the exponential curve is not really descriptive of real populations. Okay? Even though it's mathematically simple, this is not a good mathematical model, because mathematical models are supposed to represent the biological truth. Instead, we have what's shown in slide 30. This S-shaped curve, or sigmoid curve, which simply means S-shaped, is an example of the logistic curve. So this is representing not exponential growth, but logistic population growth. Notice it has a different formula. Right? dN dt, which is once again the rate of growth, is equal to R max. Now that is a constant. Okay, so even though it is a variable, you can fill it in with any constant you want. just like it was 0.5 in the last slide and 1 for the blue and the red. It's some constant. Times n, which is the population size at the moment, and then times this other thing, which collectively is k minus n over k. Well, ignore that k minus n over k for a second. If all you have is the rest of this stuff, you say, you have dn dt, or population growth, equals a constant times the population. That's exactly what the exponential curve was, right? So if you didn't have this, you would have the exponential curve. Logistic curve, in other words, is the exponential curve times this thing. But this thing that you're multiplying it by is what keeps it from being exponential forever. Instead, it starts out looking like it's exponential growth, and then it starts leveling out and approaches a horizontal asymptote, which is a value that it'll never get to, but it'll get closer and closer to. Okay? That's the dashed line here, which is called the carrying capacity. A horizontal line is horizontal because it features the same y value for any x, right? So, k here, which is the symbol for the carrying capacity, simply means the particular value of population size, a y value, that is the maximum for that population. Population can grow toward k, but it's not supposed to be able to get more than k. That's why it's called the carrying capacity. Maximum population size. Well, let me explain why this works mathematically as a model. It depends on what's happening here on this thing that you're multiplying the rest of it by. So the k minus n over k. K, by the way, remember, that is the carrying capacity. So it's going to be a different number for each different population, but just imagine it being a number. Okay? N is also a number. It's the population size at the moment. But let's imagine this population early on, when the population is very small, because it's young. So n is going to be small there, right? Not many individuals make it up. K is the same value all no matter where you are. So k minus n means k minus a very small number. Even though that's not exactly the same thing as k, when n isn't very big, k minus n is almost k, right? You see what I'm saying there? Therefore, almost k over k is almost the same thing as k over k, which is 1. And when you multiply the whole thing by 1, you're not changing it, which means it would turn it into the exponential equation. And that's why early on, populations behave as though they are growing exponentially. That's why that explains this part of the shape. Now, the other extreme is when the population is so big that it's close to the carrying capacity. When that happens, k minus n is almost k minus k, right? Because n is close to k, which means it's almost zero. And 0 over k equals 0. So when you multiply 0 by the rest of this, it doesn't matter what the rest of it is. 0 times that is 0, which means no growth. That's why it can't get more than k. So this is a much better mathematical model because it illustrates the fact that a naturally growing population can grow quickly, but then it starts slowing down in its growth because of something that causes it to be constrained or limited. That's what causes the carrying capacity. Notice, though, that if we take the derivative at any point, that's really just the slope, which represents how quickly it's growing, and it becomes steeper and steeper until we reach this special point in the middle. That's called an inflection point because the curvature changes there, right? Here we have it's concave upward until we reach this point, and then it's concave downward. And at that inflection point, that's the steepest the slope is ever going to get. If you go farther to the right, then the slope is going to get smaller and smaller as this population growth slows down. Notice, by the way, when the population growth is decreased, the population itself is still growing. It's just not growing as fast. Okay, well, let's put some numbers to this in slide 31. Easy to work with numbers. So in this fictitious population, we say that the maximum possible size is 1,500. K is 1,500. So when we plug in these different population size into the equation, we get different growth rates. When you don't have much of a population, 25, that means K minus 20, 1,500 minus 25 is still a big number. And therefore, the second part of the equation is practically 1, which is why you're practically exponentially growing. Now, the population growth rate is not maximum here, simply because it's defined by multiplying it by the population, which is still small, right? But the point is, the population growth rate is going to get bigger and bigger until you hit that midpoint. Notice where it maxes out. 375 is the maximum growth rate. And that occurs at exactly 750, which is exactly halfway to the maximum, 1,500. Just like in the previous slide, the inflection point, which is the maximum growth rate, occurs exactly halfway to K. So half of K is when a population is growing at its maximum rate possible. Then it slows down. Okay. Well, slide 32, this is just simultaneously graphing the exponential equation with the blue line and the logistic equation in the red trace, just to compare them. This is just showing you graphically what I've already told you. Early on, it seems like the population is growing exponentially, but it can't forever because it's going to be constrained by something. And whatever that something is can be different depending on the population, but something gets in the way of continuous increase in population, or in increase in population growth rate. 33. This kind of brings back up something I was mentioning before when I was talking about survivorship curves. These are different so-called strategies. Of course, evolution doesn't have a true strategy, but sometimes we use that word for different kinds of species. A dandelion is kind of like the oyster. It makes very cheap seeds, but it makes a shitload of them, not caring that the vast majority of them are not going to be lucky enough to land in a place where they can grow, so they're just wasted. They're cheap to make, though, so you make enough of them, some of them will survive. A Brazil nut tree, on the other hand, is kind of like us. Puts a lot of energy in the form of fat stored in its seeds, which is why a Brazil nut, you know, you can basically burn it like a candle. There's so much fat in it that it just will burn like a candle. Well, that's expensive to produce, but they don't make very many of them. They don't have to, because that huge energy content that they put into it is why they're able to survive so easily. So a great percentage of them do survive, and they have that type 1 versus the type 3 that the dandelions have. Survivorship, that is. Okay, more fun with graphs in 34. Totally different kind of graph here. Notice that this is graphing two things at once: birth rate or death rate. Now, one of these lines is birth rate, that's the blue one. The other one is death rate, that's the red one. Each one of those is graph versus population density, so not time, population density, which means number of individuals in a given area, right? That's the density. It's different from the size. The density has to do with how crowded they are, not with how big the overall population is. You can get a population bigger and bigger if you just keep spreading out in the area. But if you're inside a room, you're going to get a bigger and bigger density if you grow the population, because you're crowding each other. So, first of all, before I explain this, I want to say that not all of these graphs look like this. You shouldn't think that a birth rate line or curve is going to be always downward like this, and a death rate is always horizontal. This is just an example, specific example. But if you graph them both, no matter what shape they are, they will likely cross somewhere. And what does it mean when the two lines cross? Well, it means that the point at which they cross has the same value of y for both the birth rate and the death rate. Right? In other words, birth rate equals death rate where the lines cross. Does that make sense? And therefore, if we ignore the other two important things, which is amount of immigration and amount of emigration, if we just at least pretend that that's not happening, which it might not actually be happening in reality. Anyway, if only birth rate and death rate matter, then the point at which they equal each other is going to be a stabilizing situation, right? In terms of population density. It's going to be an equilibrium point, which means if you move in the x direction, either to a greater density or to a smaller density, move it to the left or the right of that equilibrium point, it's going to shift back toward that equilibrium point. Here's why mathematically. Let's go to the left. If instead of being right here where they equal each other, we perturb this to the left and say it's right here, whatever the value is, doesn't matter. Anything to the left of the black dot means now you have red lower than blue. So death rate is smaller than birth rate. If that happens, that means you're going to have more births than deaths. So obviously the population is going to grow, and therefore the density is going to increase back toward the equilibrium point, right? On the other hand, if you move it toward the right, now you have red is greater than blue. Death rate is greater than birth rate. More individuals are dying that are being born, and therefore, once again, you're going to move back toward the equilibrium place. So that's why it's called an equilibrium point. It seeks that equilibrium no matter which way it's perturbed. But notice that the blue trace, which happens to be birth rate in this case, is defined or is labeled as a density-dependent rate. We know graphically that it's a density-dependent simply because it is any slope other than zero, which the red one is, happens to be. A slope of zero means horizontal line, right? And therefore the x value does not matter. It's all the y, which is the birth rate, does not depend on the density, which is the x. But if it's any other slope than zero, if it's going upward or downward, then it does depend on the x value, right? That's what it means to be density dependent. The density of the population matters to that birth rate or death rate or whatever other measurement you're making. So we have several slides that we can also go quickly through coming up that demonstrate different ways in which the population density can become a factor contributing to that maximum carrying capacity, that K value, where it levels off. In other words, there are many density-dependent factors that constrain population growth and keep it logistic rather than allowing it to be indefinitely exponential. It just depends on the population as to what that thing is. But for it to be a density-dependent factor means that the greater the density gets, the more crowded together they are, the more they will slow down in their growth rate. So the first one is competition for resources. This is probably the easiest one to understand. Once the population gets out of hand, they simply run out of stuff they need. Right? All of the individuals, even though they're the same species, are competing for the same available resources. Now, resources includes food for like an animal, but that's resource can mean anything. It can mean amount of air, amount of light. Anything that is needed is a resource. Since that's finite, it's going to limit it. The next density-dependent factor is predation, which refers to animals eating you, animals who are your predator eating you. Well, this is a density-dependent factor because the population that is being eaten is the prey population, right? The predators are a different species, but predators eat prey. So we're talking about the density of the prey population here. When that gets out of hand, there are simply so many prey species individuals that it's easy pickings for the predators. They don't even have to exert themselves. The prey are everywhere because they're so crowded together. And therefore, they're going to be eaten faster and faster the denser the population gets, and that's going to bring it back toward a lower density. Next up in 37 is disease. Humans are a good example of this. You know, we get colds, the common cold, which the reason we get one every once in a while is because the virus that causes it mutates, so it's always a new version of a virus. Otherwise, you know, we never catch the same cold twice, because living through a cold makes you immune to it. But there's another one evolving along the way. But anyway, we tend to associate temperature with cold. I hear this all the time. Don't step out in the cold, you're going to get a cold. Temperature doesn't cause illness, right? It doesn't cause disease. It's a biotic entity like a virus that does. And so the reason that we associate it with being cold is that in places where it gets a lot colder than this, that's the time of year when you're huddled together in buildings because you don't want to go outside. And so that's the time of year when you're just spilling viruses out at each other in close proximity. Or if you travel on an airline, you're likely to get cold because you pack a bunch of 200 people into that tiny plane, breathing in each other's air. So that happens when the population density gets too big as well, right? And people start dying off because of the diseases that are caused, and that brings the density back down. Toxic wastes, the example in 38, also density dependent, controller of population. The example in this figure, by the way, is these are yeast cells. Yeast cells are famously used by humans for a variety of things, including making all sorts of alcohol, whether it's beer, wine, or spirits, booze, whatever it is. It's all the same kind of alcohol, right? Ethanol that we get by having some sort of alcohol fermenting organism like a yeast make it for us. Well, the yeast is not really trying to make alcohol. Just like we don't try to make lactic acid, which is what we make in our version of fermentation. Fermentation is something that cells have to do when they can't undergo cellular respiration. When the oxygen is low, for instance, in our own body, if we can't keep up with the oxygen demand, like when we're sprinting, then we have to switch to fermentation, because that's the only way that will allow glycolysis to continue. Well, yeast are doing this all the time, but when they do that, instead of making lactic acid, they make ethanol, which we take advantage of. But from the viewpoint of the yeast, that's really just a waste product. They're not trying to produce alcohol. They're doing the only thing they can do to keep glycolysis working so that they can keep burning their sugar and making ATP. That's no problem for a while, but eventually that alcohol level gets so high that it becomes toxic to the actual yeast. Which, this is, by the way, why we can't make wine as stronger and stronger indefinitely. All wines are about the same level of alcohol because we let that fermentation continue until the toxic alcohol, toxic to the yeast, gets so high when the density of the population of the yeast is so high that it kills them off. That's why it's a density-dependent regulator. To make it any stronger, by the way, to make gin or any other booze, you have to then, once you've done that, maximize the amount of alcohol the living things make, then you distill it, right? Get rid of the other stuff to make it more highly concentrated. But from the viewpoint of the yeast, it's just buildup of waste, and they die in their own waste eventually. That's when the density gets high enough. Territoriality is yet another one, 39. In animals, for instance, like you see here that are territorial, they defend their territories, right? It's not just that they want to be in a territory, they try to enforce that no one else gets in it. So in territorial species, there tend to be confrontations when there are two different organisms with their own territories that come into contact. Well, that's bad for both involved, right? Because if they have confrontations, if they actually have a real fight, there's chance of injury and death. They're not going to go to the doctor. If they get infected, they're going to die. So territorial species kind of just have rituals. They don't have real fights unless it gets drastic. Someone will back down and no one will get hurt, and they maintain their territory. But when the population density gets out of hand, they're all squeezed in such a small space that they're all right on top of each other, so they actually get in real fights eventually. And that leads to deaths, which brings the density back down. And then finally, it's not the last slide, but it's the last one of these density-dependent regulators. We have what's collectively called intrinsic factors, which is kind of a catch-all term. Intrinsic means happening inside. So intrinsic factors refers to physiological changes that occur when the density of the population gets too big. Like in rats, like I was saying earlier, if you're confined to a room, locked in a barn or something, and you just keep adding more and more rats, eventually you're crowding together so much that it really just freaks them out. Their physiology changes. They either stop mating behaviorally, or if they keep mating, they won't have as big a litter, or some of the litter will not survive. And any one of those three things happens, and there could be other ways as well, it's going to bring the population back down because they're not going to be as big a number of survivors. Okay, that brings us to the final slide, I think, 41, which is another graph to look at, featuring two different species here, and this is another example of a predator and prey. So you have wolves, which are the predators, moose, which are the prey. And the Y represents the number of wolves, if it's the blue one, or the number of moose, if it's the red trace. But either one of them is plotted versus time, versus year. And what you see here is that the density of one population affects the population growth of the other population. In years in which the blue trace is high, that means there's a lot of wolves, high wolf density, that's going to be bad news for the moose, right? Because the predators are everywhere. And so moose are going to really die off quickly. That's why you have the red go down when blue goes up. But then the following year, you have all these hungry wolves, but they've killed off the moose. There are not enough moose to go around to feed that many wolves, right? So now you have a lot of starvation of the wolves. That the density of the wolf population goes way down. And that's perfect time for the moose to explode in their population, right? Because there aren't very many predators at the moment. But then as soon as there's a lot of moose, then they're ripe for the picking for the wolves. And the wolves rebound and go up, which is going to cause the moose to go down again, and so on, year after year. So they just keep oscillating out of phase with each other. All right, that's enough for me. You guys are satisfied.